This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Coaches, thank you for jumping into the Talking Split Podcast. Once again, we are back after the mandatory two-week school holiday break. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me, the high-performance coach for the Country Women, Zoe Carr. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. And the high-performance coach for the Country Men, Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome back, Coops.
Great to be back, guys. Excited for this one.
Excellent. So, big thank you to all the coaches out there that have been interacting and sending in emails and all that sort of stuff over the last couple of weeks saying, where is the podcast? Obviously, you didn't listen to the last episode of the podcast where we said we would be off for 2 weeks, but we appreciate the lookout all the same on that. It is, of course, a great time to remind everyone, if they can, like, share, subscribe, rate, review the podcast, that would be fantastic. And if you can use the hashtag TalkingSplit on Twitter, I am half a chance of at least getting back to you on something in that space. Coops, if they want to interact with you on Twitter, how can they get a hold of you?
At CoachNCB.
And Zoe?
At ZoeCar85.
And I'm at Rob Coulter. So very easy on that one. Couple of big tournaments over the past 2 weeks with school holidays. We'll talk about the biggest, which was the Under-12 Jamboree up at Echuca. We'll come back to the FIBA Women's World Cup, which is, of course, the biggest. I am being facetious. But we'll talk about the Under-12 Jamboree. So for a start, Zoe, talk us through the Under-12 Jamboree. What is it? How does it run? What is it all about?
So this was my first Jamboree, and I got to say, I am so in love with this tournament, I can't even stand it. 120 girls, 120 boys, so 12 teams of 10. And it's about just a first touch point, getting them in together, getting a little bit of development. You know, we get in there and we start teaching them just the little bits, because we've got to remember they're 10. little bits and pieces of, you know, our country style of play and how we want to operate. So just tiny little things like spacing and split kick extra, and that's kind of it. And then we just let them go. But was just amazing. You know, they got to train, they got to play. Then they had their talent night, which was just unreal. The parents' night. It is such a good tournament and so good for our athletes. You know, I was talking to Kelly Wilson yesterday, who said, "Oh, I saw you were at Jamboree." And I was like, "Yeah." And she's like, "I loved that tournament." And, you know, she's still talking about it now, you know. And it's something that it's not unusual. You know, it's something that stays with our athletes for such a long time. And whilst, you know, it's a really good opportunity for Coops and I to sort of get there and get eyes on athletes and, you know, sort of see where they're at and things like that, it's not about selection. It's, you know, it's really just about exposure and getting them in and getting them enjoying it and seeing if the Vic Country pathway is something they want to pursue.
Absolutely. So Coops, multiple Jamboree attending person over there. How did this year look compared to a lot of the other years? What was good about it? What are some of the areas of improvement? Those types of things.
Yeah, a little bit different. Obviously, you know, on the back of COVID and some things like that, that just, you know, needed to be identified. But overall, you know, there's the culture side to this that I think Zoe just touched on, that doesn't change year after year of kids coming from Mildura and Bairnsdale, and Melton and Wodonga and you know, building some friendships and relationships are going to last a really long time, and that's a big part of how we develop as a country program, as a country culture, is the relationships and the community aspect of what we're doing, because that does translate to the floor. So that aspect stayed the same and it was again really enjoyable. You can see these kids starting to bond and connect over the game. More of the nuts and bolts, in terms of overall skill, you know, down, overall understanding of team concepts and how to play with each other, down. Obviously, you know, kids spending a lot of time indoors and all those sorts of things. So we've got some room there. But as Zoe said, you know, they're young and it's a first touch point. So just the fact that we had it this year, it's back. They got the exposure. They got to experience it. And now hopefully a majority of them will take that into academy and take it back to their associations, and it becomes the exciting first step of the pathway, you know, that we want it to be.
Yep, and there's a lot of stuff with that as well, where the coaches are learning concepts for the first time or the terminology for the first time, which the beauty of it is, because they get to train and play, that flow-on effect of, okay, we played 2 hours ago, Now we're going to go and train, and we're going to try and work on some of the things we just saw in that game situation and see what it looks like at the other end of it. Like, I was there on day one, and it looked very different on the last day from day one. So you can see that the coaches and the players were trying to adapt over the course. Like, day one was, I don't want to say it was diabolical, but it was chaos. Like, it was just, like, if you caught the ball in the half court, it was going up. There was no thought process whatsoever, all that sort of stuff. But the coaches did a fantastic job, and credit to the athletes too, who literally are 10 and 11 years old, for adapting and being able to be coached in that space, because that's not easy to do.
Yeah, I think one of the things that sort of was a bit of an eye-opener to me was, you know, we're talking split kick extra principles and trying to get those receiver spots in play, trying to, you know, really emphasize give up good shot for great shot and those sort of things. And then having athletes come to me and say, at my club, I'm not allowed to shoot the ball. I'm not allowed to shoot the three and stuff like that. That was a real eye-opener for me of, you know, we've got to get this message out there that, you know, our athletes aren't going to become shooters by not shooting the ball. And, you know, Coops's mantra as he falls to sleep, shooting being the master skill, you know, and we make fun, but it is true. It is 100% true. You need everyone, 1 through 5, need to be able to shoot the ball. So that sort of was a real shock to me, and trying to educate that's what I found really good about the week, was we were able to then educate those athletes, those parents, the coaches that we had there, so when they go back to their associations, then, you know, that message can be filtered through even more. And look, we all know the likelihood of a 10-year-old, you know, sticking the three at a consistent rate's probably pretty minimal. But again, we've got to allow them to do it to be able to get any chance of being able to, you know, get the next Snelly coming through, you know, who's just automatic. So, yeah, that was a big eye-opener. But, I mean, I cannot miss the opportunity to thank all the volunteers that we had up there that made that tournament just amazing. All our team managers, the coaches, the team managers, you know, everyone that just, that thing does not roll without them. And it is, I know they love it as much as we do, but that doesn't mean we don't take the opportunity to thank them for it, because without them, you know, God only knows what that tournament looks like.
Bedlam, yeah. I think it's probably the nicest way to put it. But, I mean, you hit on a couple of good points there, in that, you know, these kids are 10 and 11. A lot of the teaching that was being done from the coaches was around about what is a good shot and what is not a good shot. And just that education piece around that is, they're potentially the best kid or the best two or three kids in their team in their hometown. So they get 90% of the ball when they're playing, you know, so I'm going to shoot it every time. It's like, yeah, maybe that's not a great decision. Like, love the fact that you're trying to score, but that's just not a good shot. So the little bit of education around that, I think, is so valuable for those kids, because now it's like, well, that's the shot we want you to take. That's the one you have to go and practice. That's the good for great.
Well,
so
and
to speak.
Getting the parents on board, that is just as important. This is a perfect example of what happened. So I'm standing watching a game. We get a split. We get a kick. I thought, for sure that's going up. And we got the extra, and it was perfect. The extra shot the ball. Great. Now, the shot was not pretty. but the process and the idea and the thought and the reading was great. So I'm full. I've put my folder down and I'm clapping away, acting like an idiot. And as that shot goes up, a parent, and I assume, I hope it was the parent of the child, yells out, "No!" And it was like, oh, who's she going to listen to, me or her parent? So I pulled the athlete, there was a stoppage straight after that. I pulled her across to sort of in the vicinity of said parent and just sort of gave her the rundown of, hey, that is the exact shot I want you to shoot. Well done. We can work on that shot later. You can work on that at home. You know, the idea and the thought process of shooting that shot was right. Now I'm, you know, talking to the athlete, but I'm directing at the parent because, you know, at the end of the day, we need them on board And I think that was something we kind of came away with, that we probably need to do Coops a little bit more with the parents. And, you know, because we are trying to promote motion basketball, which is messy and horrible at times and can look very different if they've, especially if they've come from associations that are so structured. So sort of maybe, you know, getting the parents together a little bit and giving them that education might help of this is what we're looking for, this is what it's going to look like, and we're okay with that as long as we can see building and getting better.
Yeah, I mean, camps and tournaments like this one, you know, where we can prioritize development over winning, are everything to us. It's where we can really hone in on that, you know, process over outcome thinking, the process over outcome practice. And the fact that not only did we see, you know, that great possession and that player shoot that shot, but then Zoe to be able to go and connect with that athlete, but then also to avoid the car ride home post that game and have that athlete go back and just let me double down quickly on our amazing volunteers and coaches who do such fantastic work for us, to then go back with them and have that practice that you alluded to, Rob, you know, to again double down on, you know, on that process and on that, hey, that was a great shot. You know, girls, guys, you know, what an outstanding possession. This is exactly what we're trying to do, and build on it, you know, over, what is it, you know, 3-4 days. Yep. Is just so important to what we're trying to do, and hence, you know, kind of having our high performance calendar back as close to normal, you know, going into 2023 with more camps and tournaments like Jamboree is just, it's the best. You know, Zoe and I are really, really excited for this one.
And we did a little bit of work with the coaches up there as well as to what we wanted from them. And we sold those poor coaches down the river a little bit. It's like, we want you defensively up the floor. We don't care if they get beaten off the bounce, but defensively we'll want them up the floor in the full court, pressuring the ball. And you can see some of the coaches are like, yeah, this is not going to go well. Like, it's, you know,
and there were times it didn't.
There were multiple times it didn't. But to their credit, they stuck with it. Like, I don't think there was a coach. In fact, I know there was not a coach there that was trying to run up the score on someone else. They were all focused on player development, making sure all the kids were playing. They did so well out there. And what was really impressive to see was the many young coaches we had. Like, we had a couple of older heads that have, apologies for anyone that would put themselves into that demographic, but coaches that have been there for multiple jamborees, they've sort of been through it a couple of times and seen what it looks like. But the amount of young coaches we had up there that just wanted to get better and just wanted to try and improve. And I mean, we did some coach development stuff, as I said, like we did some group work. And I think on day one, to be fair, I pushed a lot of information onto them. We want this from you. This is how we want it done. This is what's going to happen. This is and this, this and this. Day two, we did a little bit of a review and it was like, okay, we'll ask you some questions and we'll see what comes back, and made sure everyone in the room had to talk at various stages. And that was a little bit uncomfortable for some of our younger coaches, but listening to them all talk about it, it's like, actually the IQ in this room is pretty good. Mm. Like the young coaches coming through have got a really good grasp on what is wanted from the BV end, because obviously they've listened to you guys or they've been at camps and those types of things. But the work the coaches did dealing with a bunch of kids they've never met before, no one really knowing what to expect as they walk in and trying to make it all work, phenomenal. Like, next level good how good those coaches were. So I cannot stress enough how good that was from a coach development perspective for those coaches to be involved with that, but also get a little bit of validation and they are doing the right thing.
Yeah, like, well, and you know I'm not one to give you a compliment, Rob, but having you there with the work that you did with them was fantastic, because we were able to watch those coaches evolve over those few days, and just to have you sitting on their benches and being able to provide feedback and things like that. And even there was one time you even provided a bit of security for one of the coaches, which is great to be able to have that. While, you know, it also allows us the ability to hone down on athletes rather than sort of splitting our time. It was fantastic, and the work you were able to do with them was great and invaluable to what we do.
Did fall into the usual. So for those of you that aren't aware, there is a coaching clinic on that goes on at Jamboree. I got dobbed in for this year's coaching clinic, which is fine. Like, no issues with that. So a 40 to 45 minute session with
parents.
With parents. It's yeah, absolutely. Parents. It is for the parents' benefit. So the topic was, you know, drills that you could do at home with your child. and made the fatal error. It was like, all right, who's the best shooter out of all these kids? One kid, like, hand goes up like a rocket, like nearly jumped off the floor. He was so enthusiastic about, I am the best shooter, and clunked all five of the shots he had to take. And it's like, yeah, I've been sold down the river here too. Like, it's, I really need to do a little bit more research before jumping on court.
The best was when he clunked one of them. It was one of those awful misses where it goes over the other side and onto the other court. And we all sat there while he had to run to the other court to retrieve his basketball.
Nah, credit to those kids too. They were fantastic. And again, from the – it sounds a little bit – actually, I've got no word for it. My English is – not great at the best of times, but I've got no descriptor for this. The amount of people that came up and said, look, we listen to the podcast, or they'd be next to you as you're having a question, their head would turn. They're like, are you Rob? Or are you Zoe? Are you Nathan? I'd be like, yeah, we are. Oh, we listen to you on the podcast. We never know what you've looked like all this time. And, you know, we listen to it. We find it really valuable. So we do obviously thank those parents and coaches and people out there that do listen to the podcast as well. And it's actually nice to meet some of you face-to-face rather than us just preaching at you for an hour every Tuesday morning that hits you guys on a Friday. So it was fantastic on that end too.
Well, I think too, Rob, just quickly as we kind of wrap up Jamboree, is that what both of you guys were able to do with the coaches in terms of hands-on development and stay connected with them throughout the week and again, provide support and resource beyond that tournament. Hopefully that's resonating right now for coaches that want to get involved in the pathway, and that being just a fantastic place to get started. And that same process over outcome applies to you. You know, if you do come and get involved, you're going to have that sort of support. You're going to get your first touch point with what we do in the program. So, yeah, if you're interested, please make sure you nominate next time.
Definitely.
And one fantastic example of one of our coaches that was very sort of shy and quiet on day one, we sort of had the chat about, look, maybe be a little bit more engaging and, you know, hands out of the pockets, walk the sidelines, those types of things. Phenomenal growth over 4 days. Was brilliant to the point where we've been able to a coaching accreditation out of it. Was then going up to the World Cup and said, yeah, I've been more watching the coaches than I have been the players. And it's like, that's cool. Like, for a young coach to sit there and say, yeah, I want to do more of that, and that's how I'm going to look at it. Unreal. So
good.
And what a segue as well to the FIBA Women's World Cup that has just finished. It's like we planned that. That has just finished over the weekend. Phenomenal effort by the Opals to get back on the podium after a number of years where they've been in the lower rankings. Unbelievable. And selfishly, brilliant to be able to just turn on the basketball at 10 o'clock and just watch it through to like 10 o'clock at night as well. Phenomenal. So really enjoyed the tournament on my end. Coos, what were your sort of thoughts of the tournament from what you saw of it?
Best brand of women's basketball I've ever seen. Like, it really showed me that there's a new floor in the women's game, and I think that's it. And just from a fan, because obviously my role is pretty limited to the men's side of the program, I really enjoyed it as a fan of basketball. I thought the women's physicality, their athleticism, their intelligence was always really good, but it's gone to this new level. And it wasn't like picking through games of like kind of who I wanted to watch. It was like, oh man, I just want to get it on. I just want to get it on and watch because of how enjoyable it was and how much I felt like it just translated to all elite or high performance basketball. That, you know, if you're a young male, you know, aspiring athlete, that you could watch these games and get something out of it and say, oh yeah, I need to work on that, or that's really cool, or, you know, those sorts of things. So just purely from that standpoint, you know, outstanding job by, you know, everyone involved in the women's game to keep it growing and get to this new level and to keep it moving forward. Outstanding job by, you know, the guys up in Sydney. Like, it looked really good. You know, it looked you know, like it was supposed to. And when you're talking about it being on Australian soil, that's important because we want these tournaments back. We want them regularly. So that was great. In terms of basketball, really exciting, you know, to see styles of play continue to grow and change throughout different nations and, you know, some things that they're trying to do based on, you know, talent pools and so on. Australia, you know, gritty defense, you know, use that to you know, to really influence their tournament and impact the game. That was enjoyable from that standpoint, like a real toughness to that group that maybe hadn't been there in the past, you know, or most recent past. Some of the talent level, Gabby Williams from France is my new favourite player.
Hold on. Are you sure? Because we were on a couple of the group chats And I feel like if we went back, Steph Talbot's name would appear.
True. Yeah. It might be a battle there between Gabby and Steph, because I mean Steph was just outstanding and really deserved that All-Star 5 nod. Like, what an incredible performance that she put in the green and gold. So the point guard number 7 for China, apologies for not remembering her name, like, what an elite guard. You know, athleticism, change of pace, adaptive finishing, passing, the way that she controlled the game, scanning. I mean, just, God, what a joy to watch. So, yeah, I know I'm kind of bouncing around all over the place, but I think that kind of accurately reflects the level of excitement that I had, you know, throughout the week and a bit for what they're able to put on.
Yep. Rest days were the worst.
Yeah.
Like, well said. Like, there were two of them during the tournament, and I hated both of them. It's like, no, I want my basketball back. Like, why do I not have a game to watch now?
Only this half a day?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Like, why has this happened? I need my 12-hour stretch where there's basketball.
I want my basketball
back. Now, Zoe, what are your sort of thoughts from the tournament as well as an observer and as a coach?
If that doesn't light a fire for young girls, young female coaches, you know, and not just females, but, you know, to start getting behind the women's game, you know, the WNBL and so on, and turning up, and, you know, because these players are playing in our leagues, you know, the Team USA players will be playing in the WNBL or have played in the WNBL and, you know, all that sort of stuff. If, you know, in terms of tactical and all that sort of stuff, I think Coops has covered it brilliantly. But my whole thing was just being able to sit there and watch with such pride of the showcase of women's basketball. You know, we often get, and I'll probably get a bit ranty here, so I apologise, but we often get labelled, you know, it's weak, it's soft, it's not as skilled, it's this and that. Well, I would counter that with watch this. You know, the basketball level, the physicality, the skill set, the tactics, you know, the coaching, the whole lot of it was just so much fun to watch and so, like, for lack of a better word, almost nourishing to me to be able to watch that. Like, you know, like, it lit a fire again. I already had it, but now it's like raging to want to be, you know, getting to those levels and supporting our game and supporting not only female basketballers but female coaches or coaches of females. It was just so exciting. It was so exciting to watch. And being on home soil obviously makes it even more special, but you pick that up and you put that anywhere in the world, other than the fact we're probably having to get up at, you know, 1 a.m. to watch it, it would still be incredible.
Yeah.
And it was so nice to see, you know, Australia, we love results. You know, we love teams that are successful. We love all of that. That team, even if they did not medal, would have been successful because it was a team we enjoyed watching play. And I got to be honest, I have not enjoyed watching the Opals in the recent past, and I think we all know why. And just being able to see them happy, to see their culture return, all that sort of stuff. There was unselfishness, there was care, there was joy, there were all these things we love to see. And it was just amazing. You know, they could have missed that medal and I still would have loved everything that they did.
And literally only a few seconds off playing off for a gold. Oh. Like, and that, I mean, that sums up tournament play in general, doesn't it? Like,
you know, heartbreaking. Yeah.
Like, if you'd got, but look at the course of the week. Like, I think after the first hour and a half that the Opals played against France, we were all probably sitting there going, oh no, like, is this going to be a really bleak week for these ladies? Like, what's this going to look like? Credit to them for bouncing back, finding a way, and tournament play again, finish on top of the pool. Like, you get the crossovers, and it's like, okay, so you've avoided the US, that's a win. You get to the other side, and it's like, geez, that first crossover, it's not an ideal one. You know, it puts you onto the China side, even playing against Belgium, who was a tough out. Like, that was not an easy game to win, and, you know, Opals did it fairly comfortably, it turns out, but Belgium's a good group. But what really took me was the absolute physicality and speed the game was played at. You saw subs coming quickly. And it's like, geez, I don't know that I'd make that sub. And it's like, then you look at the player going off and it's like, you don't have a choice. Yeah. Like, if you don't make that sub, like, you're going to hemorrhage points here. Like, it was really telling, I felt. I suppose like as much as Coops has his favourites, Gabby Williams and Steph Talbot. The person, if we had to try and find a coach of that tournament that was the most like Coops, Marina Maljkovic from Serbia. Not just for the dressing, but for the, like, loved watching her coach. It like, was so much fun.
Just her story too.
Yeah.
You know, was assisting her dad at 16, you know, in world, like in international basketball, you know, like she's just born to coach.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing.
Yeah. Head coach at 21, you know, obviously speaks multiple languages.
Yep. Changed halfway through a timeout at one start from Serbian to English. And it's like, what?
Yeah, I picked that up too. I was like, man, you were just like, you were just flowing through languages right now. Whatever you need to get your point across, like, that's pretty incredible. But tactically, was innovative, you know, had things that were kind of at the peak of basketball at the moment in how she was moving players offensively, you know, some diamond alignment, some, you know, false motion or multiple concepts building on each other. You know, defensively, she was continuing to disrupt, you know, there was changes. You know, she didn't mind, you know, moving players around, benching, you know, benching her best players.
Wow.
You know, to send a message on what they were doing. And yeah, I mean, she's my spirit animal. Like, I just, I'm so in love with this woman in how authentic she is, her coaching journey, the way she commits and loves the game and coaches her ass off and obviously loves her players. Yeah, she was a real highlight.
Yep. And they would walk through fire for her too. Oh, 100%. And you saw it. Like, they were. Like, you watch that Serbia team at the end of the week and there are black eyes everywhere. There's more strapping than you'd know what to do with on various players. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's the big thing. Like, I would really encourage coaches to go back and have a look at that tournament again. Like, if you missed parts of it, go back and watch some of the other games. Go and watch, you know, Bosnia and Herzegovina play Puerto Rico. Like, there's stuff that you can take out of that that I feel is really appropriate to our coaching. So the fact that it was in our time zone is just an absolute godsend because we don't often get it. Normally we are, oh, good, what time is that one? 4:30 a.m. Jeez, do I go to bed? Do I stay up? Like, where do I sit in all of this? It's brutal. So it was a really good spectacle. Like, I loved watching it personally, and I really do hope the flow-on effect into the WNBL this season is a really good one too, where we have a lot of those import players. Because like you touched on, Zoe, there's a number of those players at that World Cup that have been imports out here before. Like, I loved watching Kia Nurse play until we had to play her.
I was like, okay, can you go back on your minutes restriction, please?
Exactly. Are you up at 18, 19 minutes? Because I know you can only play 20. Is there any chance you can just sort of shelve yourself for a bit? But it's just seeing that world-class basketball, and we haven't even touched on the USA team and the star-studded group that they brought across as well, and even being able to deal with not having Chelsea Gray, Asia Wilson and Kelsey Plum for the first couple of games as they just worked them back in. And it's like, gee, that's a nice luxury. Like, I don't know if any other countries will be able to do that. But just the level of talent they had there. And there are times, and similar sort of deal, like Ionescu and I've blanked on the other player that was starting and playing big minutes early in the week. Those three players come in, they go to the end of the bench and it's like, oh, it's just what you do.
Yeah.
Like, that's just the pecking order they'd established and the culture they clearly had within the group.
Yeah, well, I mean, the biggest thing for mine was it seems to be the first team USA in a long time that defended and were completely unselfish. Mm. You know, it was all about getting each other open, getting the best shot. Now, obviously, there were times where you go, oh, that shot probably wasn't the right shot, but that you're going to have that in any game with any team. But this Team USA, I think I might have actually said to you, Rob, at one stage, like, it annoys me that I don't hate them. Like, you know, as a, you know, the big dogs, you want to kind of hate them. You want to say that they're arrogant and they're this and they're that, and they just weren't. Mm. They went and they played for each other and they defended everything, and it was like, damn.
And there was still bulk swag about them. Like, when Chelsea Gray was in the building, you knew Chelsea Gray was in the building. Like, and she was next level as well. Like, you don't have to be a genius to work out that she's a talented athlete. Like, you know, does she look like the normal point guard? No. But I think anyone would walk into a gym and go, that's the best player here.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a massive, good job on talent ID. Like, know, we know. But as we're talking about the changes, like, even the Opals, like, Tolo didn't start the start of the week. And the change was made after that first game against France, where Tolo was amazing and phenomenal over the course of that lineup continued to change. Like Ezzy went to the bench, then she started. Kayla George went to the bench, and then she came back in. Like Sarah Blitzavs, that you know probably wouldn't have said she was going to be a starter at any stage during the week. Beck Allen goes down, and all of a sudden Blitzavs is a starter and was very serviceable.
Yeah.
Like she gave a really good account of herself too. So just the ups and downs of tournament life. You know, we know it. It doesn't always look like you think it's going to look, but what a phenomenal event.
Yeah.
Like it's just the more we can get of those, the better. So, BA, if you're listening, please continue to tender for those types of events if you can.
Yes, please.
Wouldn't hate it in Victoria. Yeah. Just saying, like if we could get that down here, what would we quadruple the stands?
Let's have it at the MCG.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like we could do that. Like it's well, Docklands that thing.
Well, Dock. Yeah, yeah. Marvel Stadium is ready to go.
Absolutely. So phenomenal event. So we do hope that we get some access to that again in the future. So we've gone 30 minutes without actually talking about the topic of the podcast, which is somewhat reminiscent of how most of these things go, and then get gradually edited down so that we can get to that point. But this is a fairly stressful time of year for everyone, players, coaches, parents alike, because it is team selection time. So we are going to talk a little bit about how to actually pick a team in the first place, because let's face it, everyone has an opinion. You could have gone through that entire World Cup roster and said, oh, yeah, but what about, and how about if this, and what if? And a lot of it is down to personal preference of the coach, the athletes, you know, they are who they are. Like, I don't think anyone really is in that position where they have just a plethora of talent to pick from. You know, I think the best 7 or 8 kids are probably going to stand out in any trial fairly quickly, and then you're sort of looking at what are the extra places made up of from that point, which we'll touch on in a little bit. So a couple of things I'd ask of you guys. What templates are you using for trials to actually select kids in the first place? So as a coach and you're turning up, what's the first thing that you're looking at as you walk into a trial?
Yeah, I think clearly having clear expectations and clear communication around what you're doing. So one part of that is selection criteria. So exactly what are you specifically looking at in terms of these athletes? And then the other one, and Rob, I know you and I have been speaking about this for a long time since our first go-round together on a state staff. Are you a system coach, and are you selecting athletes for that system where you're so good at your system that you can utilize that to impact games and obviously have success, and then you know how to plug players into that and to do it? Or are you picking the best kids available and you'll create a system around the talent? And I think where we fall into the trap is we tend to kind of fall in between those two things. Yeah. You know, we're somewhere in the middle. We don't quite know what we're doing, and we don't clearly communicate that. So if you were a system coach, you'd like to start that selection process off by saying that this is what we're going to run. These are the players I'm looking for to plug into that system. Or obviously you would say, you know, the other, we're just looking for the best kids available. So I think you have to have that self-awareness or that connection with your director of coaching or whoever it may be to say, this is how we're going to go about it, and then create your selection criteria for that too. So, you know, are you going to be position specific? You know, do you want to go into that sort of depth, especially if you're talking about your system? Or like more so with us, you know, we have our six pillars or our six principles, which, you know, clearly identify the things that we've prioritized and that we're going to select on. And then obviously we have some style of play and systems that we'll adjust as we go forward. So I think if you start with clear expectations and clear communication, you're going to set yourself off, you know, on the right foot.
Yeah, and that, I mean, You alluded to it there, but like Trevor Gleeson is going to run flex. So he's going to find players that are suitable for flex. So it's a really easy thing for him to go searching for. Now, again, we're talking about a pro level rather than a junior level where, you know, things are obviously very different there. But he has got a very clear identity as to what he is as a coach. And I think that's a really interesting reflective process that you can have prior to when trials commence. Like I know with my, and I'll talk about this when I do my season review on the podcast in a few weeks' time, but I know with my group that I had this year, we went in and we gave them the offense beforehand. Like we had a Zoom meeting because I think we were just coming out of COVID lockdowns at the time, but we gave them the session plan. This is what we're doing at trials. These are the offenses we're going to run. Here is an animation of what that's going to look like. Here is some video of what that's going to look like. Get prepared so that when you walk in the door, I know who's done the work, who's doing what. So
love that.
For me, it was a lot easier. Now, it didn't work out perfectly, to be fair, but it was one of those things where we tried to be a little bit more proactive that before they've even walked in the door for trials, here's all the information. Here's what you need to know. Like this sort of stuff is what you'll be assessed on. Here's how we go about it. And to be fair, by under 18s, they should know a lot of that stuff. They're fairly self-aware. Like, if you surveyed a group of kids at an under 18s trial, they could probably pick the team for you. Like, it's not too difficult. But in the lower age groups, that's difficult. So the projection of talent, I suppose, Zoe, how do you get that done when you've got 90-odd kids at a training session? You maybe only know three or four of the better kids, but you've got to pick six teams out of it.
Yeah, so if they've been in your program, you know, the only real excuse for that is under 12s, where they're new into your program. Other than that, you should have an understanding or at least a base knowledge of the athletes that are going to fall in your whatever team you're coaching in. So, you know, if you've got the ones, you need to know the best probably 15 to 20 kids in your club. You know, obviously people move, come in, go out, all that sort of stuff, but you have to have a general knowledge of that going in. I think something that's really important that that coaches need to lock down, and it comes with what Coops is talking about having a clear understanding and clear communication. If your club has, and I hope they do, an emphasis on long-term athlete development, you need to be aware of that, and you need to be aware of the expectations that surround that. So if you're coaching a first team and your DOC says to you, hey, this kid is, it's under 14s, but he or she is 6'3", struggling to be able to catch, struggling to be able, because the body has grown and they're just taking that little bit longer for it to all click, you have to play them. And it's a conversation you need to have with your DOC, because there's no point having them in that team if they're not going to play. So that conversation needs to happen as to, okay, if you're not sure how to get that done, speak to your DOC about how do I use them, where do I put them in at what times, that sort of stuff. And if that's not for you, then that's not for you, and take a different team. I know that sounds easier said than done. It's actually quite easy. Teams are screaming out for coaches all the time. So, you know, it's got to be something that you're on the same page as what your club wants. But being across the age groups is really, really important. Under 12s, you're probably going to have a massive amount of kids.
That all look the same.
That all look the same. They're all the same height. Yeah.
Jack,
they're all
or
named
Sarah.
Ruby.
Yeah,
like it's but it's really important for me, and I'm maybe going a little bit off topic, but get into gameplay as quick as you can. You don't need to see if a kid can dribble 1-on-0 or stationary or, you know, quick warm up, and then get them into gameplay and, you know, see what they can and can't do. Give them as much opportunity as possible to show you what they're capable of. You know, we all know athletes that are good trainers but poor trainers, good gamers, or I don't know if I just said the same thing
you
twice.
Did, but that's okay.
But you know what I mean. Switch it over. But, you know, it's you've got to get that at the end of the day, you're picking them to play. So you need to see what they can do from a playing perspective. And I think sometimes we get caught up, you know, doing, you know, ball handling drills and things like that. Mm. And, you know, I think we've got to get out of that as quick as we can.
Yeah, isolation drills.
Yeah.
That don't transfer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you're going to spend 15 minutes of a trial on five-man weave, you know, like that's not helping. You're wasting valuable time. I think the other part of that too is information transfer. Like if you're going to coach and your expectation is that you're going to have significant information that you're going to give these athletes, let's say probably if it's a higher age group, around, you know, hey, we're going to run this offense or we're going to have this concept. Can you learn it in a short period of time, and can you transfer it on the floor and run it to some sort of reasonable level? To, you know, showing us that you have that ability, that, you know, that coachability. Sorry, Zoe, jumped.
Yeah, no, for sure. It's spot on. And it's something that, you know, if you are going to put something in, don't spend time on something that you will take out of the scrimmage. So what I mean by that is when Coops and I head to camp, we've got a real emphasis on get other people open. You know, so the on-ball screen isn't, you are not allowed to participate in that unless it's the last 8 seconds for the older age groups. The younger age groups, you're not going near it. And it's because we want to see, can they get open through cuts? Can they get open through screen away and spacing and split kick extra and those sort of things? So we don't spend any time in our camp working the on ball because we're not going to allow them to do that in the scrimmage. We're going to spend time on the concepts they're allowed to do. So I think sometimes we want to try and pack so much into our sessions or into our trial to try and get as much info to the kids as possible, and it's certainly not a bad thing, but we need to be a bit more strategic about how we go about it.
Yeah, and it is one of those difficult areas too where you are trying to make assessments on kids, and so it's really difficult to make an assessment on someone that's just doing like Titan shooting. Like that's yeah. not going to...
I'd look pretty good in Titan, I reckon, right now.
Even I could still stick a jumper if you gave me enough opportunities. But it's one of those things too where are the coaches watching that? If they are watching that, what are they taking out of that? Is it a case of they can make shots in that but they can't make shots in games? Those types of things that really sort of matter, I feel like. So if you are walking around as a coach and you're trying to pick your team, I'd certainly suggest like a clipboard with some notes on it as to what would I be giving feedback on this athlete if I had to give feedback on it, because you can bet your bottom dollar someone will ask, why did that child make the team over that child? Mm. What's the difference between? You want to have something you can go back to, not just have, oh, they had red shoes. Yeah. That's not helpful.
Well, and just a little, I guess, note for that for coaches, don't ever discuss anyone else's child with somebody. You know, you'll discuss their child and that is it. Yep. Because that's not their business. And if somebody's asking for that information, they're not interested in feedback. They want to try and justify things and try and even maybe change your mind. So don't allow that to happen. But another little trick, I guess, especially in those settings, you know, I'm a big advocate of keeping parents out of trials. And, you know, no disrespect, parents, but I find it's easier for the coaches to be able to have discussions without being worried about who's around, because we need to be able to have those discussions and we definitely don't want to offend anybody. But we also find that the athlete's anxiety tends to drop a bit.
Yeah.
And we're able to...
They're not looking to the stands.
They're not looking, yeah, you know.
What do you think? Is this still good or bad?
Exactly. Yeah. You know, that sort of, it sort of calms them a little bit because they're not on show to anybody, not just their parent, anybody else that's in the stadium. It's just them, some players and basketball. So keeping them, I'm a big advocate of that, and I can't actually remember where I was going with it.
I think what you were going to talk about was parent coaches in particular, because how they get involved with discussion points around, they have to be at that trial anyway, but they also then have to sort of sit back a little bit as to, well, where does my child sit? Do I get to have an opinion on those? I know you two, when you do trials and what generally happens is the boys and girls are on the same day, and if it's a male athlete, you try and put them on the girls' side and those types of things. But when you're having those discussions, you do ask the parent to leave the room just so you can have that very open and transparent discussion about, look, where do they fall? Where do they fit? And I think the big thing is that whoever's leading those meetings needs to say, well, look, I think they'll be a threes kid for argument's sake. Excellent. Are we all comfortable with that? We're working around this. No problems. Parent can come back in the room and then work it out afterwards. But I think it is a discussion that's probably best done in private with the parent, if you are the person leading that, to just sort of say, look, here's where we feel they'll fall. Let them have their reaction to it, whether it be good, bad, or any different. And I've seen plenty of coaches go, like, are you serious? You're picking them in the twos? And it's like, oh, did you think they've been the ones? And they're like, no, I want them in the fours.
In
like
fairness, I've seen more of that than anything else.
Yeah. But it is one of those important ones too, where they have to be involved and they have to be aware of what's going on. But just that confidentiality thing is vital, I feel like, at selections. Like, it's, you have to be able to talk candidly about why you're picking kids and where you're picking them and those types of things. That can't leave the room. And the amount of stories we have that come back with, oh, a coach in the room said this. And it's like, how would you know that? And it's like, well, a coach has obviously leaked it. And that's an issue for us, because that's the easiest way to never be invited back to something again. It's like, well, if I can't trust what's going on and what we say is not leaking out, you're probably not coming back as a coach. So have to be very mindful there too.
Yeah, just want to echo that sentiment, Rob. Like, we have that discussion, you know, prior to every camp around, you know, that, and this obviously not only goes out to our network coaches already with us, but also prospective ones, is that to be in that room, there is a huge level of trust, and that we're extending that trust to you, and then what you do with that trust is up to you. And obviously, if coaches want to go and have those conversations, that's fine. But we'll take the polo back, and you won't be welcome back into that room. So obviously, that's a that's a big part of it. So, how we're modeling correct selection behavior and processes is really important to Zoe, myself, and our Metro colleagues, that we want to have integrity around what we're doing and show the community that that's the best way to operate.
Yep, without question. So one of the things, I'm sure every coach would have probably a depth chart as to who's going to go where and roughly. Be really careful with that too, because I'm sure every coach would do this. Realistically, after the first trial, you should probably be able to pick your first two teams or be very close to picking your first two teams. If there's a little bit of a swing in there and maybe the first squad has 12, that's cool, similar deal. Be very careful of that cascade effect though. Like if you have four squads of 12, two kids will drop down, which means four kids drop down, which means six kids drop down, which all of a sudden means there's an extra team in there. It's like, hey, where'd that extra team come from? My kid was in the threes and now they're in the fives. Like, what happened here? You do have to be very mindful of that too. So I know a lot of clubs have gone about naming squads as colours instead so they don't get in their mind, oh, but I was in squad one and now I've ended up in team two. Yeah, that's kind of how it happens, because some kids do have to fall down the pecking order, so to speak, as you do start to pick teams. So it is something to be very mindful of too, just making sure that you're not setting unrealistic expectations about what team numbers potentially kids are going to fall into.
I think part of that too is that preparation piece that, when I was a director of coaching, it was really important that we had the handover notes. At the end of every season, the coach below, wrote those notes up to hand to the coach above. Here's some background on the athletes. And it wasn't ranking, it wasn't anything like that. It was just some sort of information that was going to help with that process. And and again, hopefully, if we can utilize that first trial, as efficiently as possible, maybe get at least our first team done. It's going to allow us more time for where we know we're probably going to spend the most time, which is those athletes around the second, third and fourth team that are a little bit closer in skill, a little bit closer in size. We want to have, just the extra look at them.
Well, it's, if you can't pick your team at the end of it, you probably shouldn't have the job. Like of that first session, I've seen first team coaches they have four trials and they've used all four trials to pick their first team. Yeah. It's like, have a thought for the second team that now can't pick theirs, the third team that now can't pick theirs, yep. The fourth team that now can't, and then just down the line, you have to get that thing done quickly. Yeah. And if you say, look, I've got 11 kids, I can't swing pick between these two, okay, take the extra session, that's fine. But come on, like we've got to get this done a lot quicker and just more respectful out of the coaches that are down the line, who, to be fair, are coaching teams that probably they would prefer not to coach. Like if you have the option of a first team or a fourth team, you're probably going to take the first team if you have the option. So if you've put your hand up for a fourth team, credit to you.
Yeah.
It's a great thing that you're doing. You're getting kids on court and playing. But allow them, I don't want to say the luxury, but just the courtesy, I suppose, of being able to pick their team and being able to be in the right space with that, I think is vital.
Yeah, I think, that's where it comes back to understanding your age group and understanding who sort of sits around about where before it even begins. First teams should probably have, on a depth chart, maybe 15 or so kids. Now, again, things change, kids grow, all that sort of stuff. So you're certainly not shut off to anybody, but, you've got that there and you're able to work from that as quickly as possible. And it helps with your efficiency because you're spot on. I've sat in lower teams before going, I have no idea what's coming down, then what I've got to cut from there and all that sort of stuff. You start to build relationships. I've been a part of a trials process that went for about 6 weeks, which isn't, I believe, insane. But you start to build relationships with the kids and then it's like, oh, now I've got to cut you. it's something that it just needs to be going a step further, I guess, with, things like mental health and anxiety the way they are. Particularly coming out of COVID, the quicker and more efficiently you can get this done, because anxiety is high, the better. And even if it is that you're cutting athletes, it's better to just get it done as quick as possible rather than draw it out to have the same outcome.
Well, let them go to another club if they want to as well. Like if you can let a kid know by the end of the first session, look, we probably don't have a spot for you in our program, that's fine, because now that athlete's got opportunities to go somewhere else and try and get that game if they want that game.
Yep.
And, we joke about it a little bit. We don't enjoy cutting kids. Like, it is one of those areas that, is tense for everyone involved. Coops. It's different. Like, it's, you know.
No, we pick on it. But it's something that we kind of do have to try and laugh about it because it is actually painful. Yeah, we don't.
Coops watches that Bart Star episode of The Simpsons beforehand, like, and just channels his inner Homer when he's rolling through.
But if we don't, it does weigh on us. I know there's probably a lot of people out there that think, you know, when it comes to state team selections in particular, that, you know, that we're happy about what we've had to do. We're happy we've been able to pick a team, but we're not happy about the kids we've had to cut to get there. That's, you know, so we do use humour to try and, you know, mask that sort of stuff. You know, we laugh at Coops and tell him that he's Homer in that episode and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't take away how difficult it still is. Doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. It's, yep. Yeah.
And how do you get balance in team selection? Because that is one area, and, you know, I'm somewhat biased towards it, whereas if you're over a certain height in an age group, there's a reasonable chance you'll come into my court and we'll reevaluate you. Like, there is a bias over the taller, more athletic athletes in that space. How do you make sure that your group is balanced, but also you're not missing anyone that you potentially need on your court?
It's a really good question. And
every now
one.
And again, Coop, yeah. Like, I think we're like seven seasons in. I think this might be number two.
Chalk it up.
Yep.
I think, again, it comes back to really clear understanding of what you're in this for, what are the athletes in it for, and what are the expectations around, again, how you're going to coach and potentially success versus development. So if I am in a second or a third team, I'm thinking LTAD. I'm thinking this is development. You know, do I need the third point guard? Do I even need the second one? Is there a bigger kid there that we could maybe just blood in that position, as we know that, you know, the further up the line, big guards are being asked for? So, yeah, having those thought processes around, you know, where am I in the journey? Where are the athletes in the journey? And what are we trying to get out of this? Like, that should be that kind of first conversation. Now, if you're the A-teens first team at a big club and there is some expectations around winning, and we know that the winning may connect a little bit more to some exposure and going on to different things, now we're having a different conversation. Okay, we only have one point guard. I know that, you know, club A, B and C are going to press us heavily this year. Second ball carrier is going to be really important. Okay, so let's look at, you know, what that position is going to be, who are the athletes that fulfill that role, and then who is moving out the back of the roster and maybe down to the second team, and what sort of conversations am I now having with that second team coach and my director of coaching around what does their year look like? So they're originally going to be a 2 and 3, 3 and D wing for us, you know, more of a role player. We've brought in the guard there now in the twos, higher expectations. Okay, let's now talk about, okay, well, maybe they need more opportunities to get their feet in the paint and develop that side of their skill level. So I know that's not the simple answer. I know there's a lot of moving pieces to that, but I think when we're talking about giving the athletes the best chance of success, really investing in their development, that these are the conversations and the self-evaluation that we need to have on a regular basis.
And sometimes it is better to go and play in the twos for an athlete. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we have this, I suppose, conversation a lot. Are you better off being the 10th player in the first team or the first player in the second team? It's like, well, give me the first player in the second team any day of the week. Like, it's, you probably still get to train with the first team because most teams do train together in that space. More court time, more shots, more decisions, more responsibility, more learning how to carry a team. And I think that's invaluable. Like, and, you know, this is a chaotic time of year as every man and their dog, it feels like, tries to change clubs or look for, oh, is the grass actually greener over there? No, it's not. It's artificial turf. Like, it's it's one of those areas where everyone wants to try and shift potentially to win. I feel like it is usually the big area. It's like, oh, I think that's a better team, so I'll just go and play there. And it's like, actually, no, don't. Like, stay where you are and learn how to carry a team. Like, I mean, Zoe, that's your junior career.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, you went through it a lot.
Yeah, and it's not to say that my team wasn't talented. They certainly were, but there were some, you know, super teams even back then. And, you know, I was constantly getting pressure to go to those clubs. And I'd love to say it was brilliant foresight from myself and my parents to say, no, no, these are the reasons why you're going to stay. You're going to learn how to put a team on your back. You're going to learn that you have to turn up every week, and because if you don't play well, we don't win. And, you know, you're going to learn all of these things. It wasn't. The answer was, I'm not driving past one club to get you to another. But I can't I don't think I would have been half the player that I was without that experience, you know, of, you know, I had to have a presence. I had to have impact. And that wasn't necessarily me scoring or doing those things. It was, how do I bring my teammates into it against these super teams? And, you know, I had to think my way through and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, you're on a team that just wins by 50 every week. How much thinking are you really doing? How many decisions are you actually having to make? It's minimal, because your team's just going to out-athlete, or, you know, out-talent, rather than, you know, the chess game, I guess, which makes you a better player.
It's funny. Like, one of our favourites, Coops, Anthony Karabatos,
yeah,
back in the day.
Yeah.
Like, he left a stacked Melbourne team to come and play at Diamond Valley, who, yeah, he knew was a weaker team, but had some decent pieces around him. But that was his theory. Like, I'm not going to get any better winning by 50 points every week, and every now and again when we play you guys, winning by 25. Like, that was the theory. It's like, well, if I can go and be somewhere, I'm still going to get coached, I'm still going to get developed, I still have players around me that can help me try and win. But now that margin comes back in, you know, that makes a lot more sense for those types of athletes. So you do have to look at, I think, the situation you're in as the coach, as to, you know, am I doing the right thing by this athlete? Do I have, and it seems stupid, but do I have too much talent here where my first team is going to win by so much? Could we split this? I don't know, I'm outlandish statement here. Are you better off having two even teams where they can both potentially make VC or a higher grade? Maybe. Yeah, that's something to consider.
Yeah, I don't think that's outlandish at all. You know, you want to stop players walking out the door, play them. You know, if you want to stop players walking out the door, develop them. You know, at the end of the day, it's not on the player leaving, it's on you as director of coaching or a coach. Around what sort of environment are you creating? What sort of opportunities are you giving these players? There's no reason why you can't have some sort of even court time guideline, you know, through your first three quarters. Again, you know, just harping back on my experience as a DOC, we had that. We put that in place. We said it didn't matter what level of team you're at, that everyone got even court time the first three quarters, and then the last quarter determined on the outcome of the game. Again, because, you know, teaching players how to win and so on is obviously a big part of what we're trying to do. But, you know, develop these players, give them the court time. Just because they're the 10th player on the first team, it's not professional basketball. It doesn't mean they're a garbage time player. That does not exist in VJBL basketball. Yep. I'm just going to say it again, coaches. The 10th garbage time player that you see on an NBA team, that role does not exist.
There
in the
is no
VJBL.
Need to pay rent.
Yeah, that's not how it works. You know, we've got to get these kids on the floor. We've got to get them loving the game. We've got to get them better.
That just plays into something, though, that it may be unpopular, but I wish I could see this across the, particularly the VJBL, in 10 players per team. You know, the games are 8-minute quarters. If you're not in VC and the clock's not stopping on every stoppage and all that sort of stuff, that's a, you know, 32-minute game. If you play half of that, 16 minutes, you've driven to, you know, Bellarine, yeah, or something like that for 16.
Bellarine caught some flack on this podcast.
I know. It's because my parents have a beach house down there.
To be fair, it's usually for me. But they are usually if we have to talk about having to travel somewhere, it's usually Bellarine that cops it.
Yeah, well, I actually like traveling down
Great
that
job,
way.
Bellarine, making Rob and Zoe travel all the time. Great job by you.
Yeah, they keep making grades. Good for them.
Exactly.
That is crazy to me. And if you've got even court time with 10 players, that's all you're going to get. So I just think, you know, okay, if you want to have 10 in your main team and you've got a coach that's got the ability to get them through and get them all decent court time, I don't see the issue with 9 and even 8 as you get lower. You know, I do understand from a club perspective of then you've got to find coaches for more teams and things like that.
And I'm sure financially it plays a part too. Like, well, you know, if you have those extra two players, that's two extra lots of registration that come in the door, and
And but those players are still playing, and they're more likely to stay. Coaches. That's what I mean. Yeah. But they're more likely to stay because they're playing. And this is the like what you're saying, Coops. Like we continue to have 10 in every team, from the first team to the sixth team, and there are not enough minutes in the game.
Yeah,
you know, there's just not. And for the amount of travel that they have to do, and the amount of commitment they have to give. No wonder they're walking out the door, and particularly female athletes, you know, they will look at that and go, this is not worth my time. I could go and work. I could go hang out with my friends. I could, you know, focus on my studies. I could do, you know, they will look to other things quicker than you can imagine. They need to feel like they're a part of it and that they're getting something out of it. And to do that, they signed up to play. They didn't sign up to train. So, you know, I would implore clubs to have a look at it. And again, I know it's difficult in the sense that, you know, you've got to find more coaches. So I do understand that, and I'm certainly not being flippant about that. But at the end of the day, we're in this for the players, and they need to play. Yep. And to do that, 10 is just – it's just not going to work.
So we're talking the VJBL level. Let's go up a level and – I mean, both of you have been involved with Oz teams and selection processes that go with that. So just to give a little bit of, I suppose, clarity for those that are potentially curious about it, how the heck do you go about selecting an Oz team in a two-day camp where you're potentially seeing, you know, 24 kids on the court, 18 of which you've seen before, six have come from a project that maybe this kid will work out. Like, Zoe, you've just been announced as the under-15 head coach for Guam later in the year. So it's November, I'll say. We're running out of months, so it must be November.
Yes.
So how did you go about it to start? You weren't at AJC's this tournament, so you didn't even get a say on what your camp roster looked like.
No.
It was just, here you go, enjoy.
Pick from this, which was fine because, you know, the boys had the same thing as well. So the squads were picked before we were announced. So it was just a case of getting onto the game replays and watching nationals. Those things became invaluable, you know, statistics, all those sort of things. At the end of the day, you know, you have to be really precise. It's sort of what I mentioned before about what you're wanting to get out of it. So, you know, we've got that two-day camp and that's kind of it before we go. So it was important we got our defensive rules in. It was important we got our transition rules in. It was really important we got our zone offense in. And then we've really just got a man offense to go from there and play. So there was a lot of scrimmage-based stuff, you know, a lot of teaching. And it was, again, what Coops mentioned. And Pat Hunt actually came and spoke to the athletes and said about, it's really important now that they're at this level that they become international learners. And in classic Pat fashion, he was able to just slice it down into its simplest form, which is they have the ability to listen, understand, and do quickly. Like, that's it. That's their that's an international learner. And you sit there and go, oh, that would have probably taken me like three paragraphs to come up with. But it was about identifying those athletes because, you know, it's not just about who are, you know, you're getting to that level. You do need, you know, the best kids. But you also need to have foresight into the fact that this age group will eventually go to a Worlds. Whether I'm coaching it or not, someone is going to take them to a World Cup, this age group, in 2 years. You need to make sure that your size in particular, because at this age group, it's easy to leave the size out because they're taking that bit longer to get to the level of the guards. But someone's got to take some size to Worlds. You can't go to Worlds without size. So giving them that experience and not to say they're not up to it, they absolutely are, but it's just one of those things that they're always the contentious selections, I guess. And
take 7 point guards.
That
will go well.
Yeah.
You'll probably win early, but you won't win late.
And that's the thing, you know, and I would feel absolutely horrendous, not only for the athletes, but certainly for if I'm not the coach that takes them to Worlds, that I didn't set this program up in the right way. Like, we've got a responsibility not just to what we're doing. It's not just about this week that we're about to go. This is a cycle. So we have to be forward thinking. So getting combinations in, seeing who can do what, seeing who can, you know, thrive under certain circumstances, who buckles under certain circumstances, and the ability to be able to transfer quickly was massive, because we're going to have to put more and more things and evolve over the week because we haven't had the time, which is just a, you know, it's a product of, a product of where we're at the moment with the amount of things that are going on and lack of weekends and weeks and stuff to get things done. So it is vital that the athletes are able to take information and transfer. So they were probably the biggest points for me going in.
So, I mean, you've been involved with this a number of years as well. How did you go about trying to balance? Yeah, obviously you want to win now with the junior national team. Like, there's world rankings on the line and all those types of things. But the junior national program is there to try and produce senior national athletes as well. How did you go trying to balance that out between the two?
Yeah, look, it's a discussion that you're having right from the get-go. You know, you're having discussions with the guys at BA, with the guys at the COE about, you know, who are these athletes? How do they potentially progress through the pathway? What do they look like? And how are they going to impact the Boomers or the Opals? So it's not even so much that it's just on the coaching staff to kind of figure that out. It's actually a real joint process, with, you know, some of our best minds in the sport, which also makes the experience pretty cool that you can have these really in-depth conversations, you know, around athletes and how you're potentially going to impact future green and gold. You also get two extra spots, which is really lucky. You know, when you're talking about 11 and 12, how they're going to impact rotations, it is green and gold. Now things like playing time and whether those last two athletes actually play does come into play, you know, come into place. So they're two really helpful spots. A great example for us when we went away to the World Cup in 2018 to Argentina, Blake Jones. Blake Jones came as, you know, kind of a later pick for us, you know, still developing. But you just looked at him and it was like, that's a future Boomer. That's what a future Boomer looks like. You know, how much is he going to impact the tournament? Well, that's going to be up to him as we move through the campaign. But, you know, off the back of that, he goes on to be, I think it was back-to-back under 20 MVPs, you know, has some minutes with the Brisbane Bullets as a development player. He's now off at George Mason, you know, pretty decent Division One school, and, you know, is set up hopefully to fill, maybe fulfill that role one day. So it's a joint process. It's a lot of conversations. It's a lot of analysis, and it's, you know, how does this thing fit into to now versus then? So it's interesting, but it's a lot of fun.
It's such a good point. Like, we were just away this year and we took Sarah Portlock, who in experience terms was probably on the lower end of experience, but she's 6'7". And, you know, look at our – let's look at the Opals, use them as an example. So we've got LJ, phenomenal, but done, right? We've got Tolo and Francis coming toward the end of their careers, internationally in particular. If we don't invest in these athletes and we don't give them that exposure – and that experience, and then by the time they're old enough to then maybe transition into like Opals or Boomers, by the time they then get there, then we'll all complain that they don't have the skill set that they need because we haven't done that work earlier. And I think, like you said, those extra two positions become so important, you know, managed the right way. But, you know, it is so much more than I think people understand, you know, or are aware of.
Yeah.
You know, like, there are so many more things that we need to consider, and it's not just about that team right there for that tournament then. You know, we've got to forward plan this stuff as well, so we make sure that we're doing our job as the coaches of that team for that tournament, but we're also doing our job contributing to the pathway and contributing to, you know, like you said, future green and gold, because at the end of the day, you know, watch what those Opals did over the last week, you know, if any of the athletes that we are in contact here that we've taken become that, like, amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing. And that should be the forward goal. That should be the main goal.
But you'd be lucky out of any Australian junior team to get one Boomer and Opal out of them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it sounds flippant, but it's kind of how it works too.
It still is. It's 1-2%.
Yeah. Like, it's still not many when you really put it in context. And it's one thing to go and have a really good AJCs as an athlete, but it's another thing to go and be a good international basketballer. And they're two very different styles of play. And we talk about it even jumping up from domestic basketball into VJBL, VJBL into state teams into Oz stuff. Yeah, they look great at that level, but does it translate to the next level? And even just seeing like the size that China rolled out with at that Opals World Cup, it's like, man, like, you can't go with an undersized big against them. Like, they are just going to torture you. And both of the women that they picked in those positions could shoot the three.
Yep.
Oh, there's at one stage, like, I can't remember her name, the big they brought off the bench, like, stepped out and shot a three. And it's like, you've got to be kidding.
Well,
like,
and that's it was not nice, fair. And it would too. Look good. Like, it was,
no, that's not fair. Like, you should be able to do that. That's crazy. So you look at it from a holistic perspective, and it's like, yeah, the job of coaches to pick teams, it doesn't get any easier just because you have more talent. If anything, it becomes harder.
Well, and that's a really good point that you made, is that, you know, you watch things like AJCs, for example. So we're talking green and gold selections. You watch things like AJCs, and certain athletes, you know, may have amazing stat lines, but you need to look deeper into those stat lines. Are those stat lines against the other athletes at camp, or are those stat lines against players that have not made the cut to come to camp? And if it is the latter, then, you know, those things, it doesn't often translate. They come to camp and, it exposes things. There are so many things and influences to look at, and you've got to do that deep dive. Otherwise, you know, you may end up either missing somebody or selecting somebody that, you know, you find it then difficult to play.
I mean, that's a good insight right there, is that you see, you know, numerous players go to junior national team camps that haven't quote unquote put up numbers at an AJC, because exactly what Zoe's talking about, it's such an in-depth process, is what is their mobility like for their size, you know, how big are they, how does that transfer to international basketball? You know, they shot the three really well, but they only shot limited attempts. Well, looking at the size and the fact that they could defend, and that they're probably going to be a role player in terms of how they're going to relate to maybe some of the other players who are putting up numbers, well, they're the things that we're looking for. Because to come back to our previous point around how do you pick a team, and in terms of do you take the best or so, when you get to green and gold, you really are now starting to think about every single position, you know, differently. We do need certain number of this, we do need certain number of that, because we have gone and had past experiences, and we have looked at international basketball. There are tournaments happening in Europe. There are tournaments happening in Asia where we get to see these teams play and what they look like and what's the style. And we need to think about how are we going to counter that? Or do we go another way and they have to counter us? And then again, that's going to impact, you know, the new two-year cycle for us, which is Oceania, ANIA, Asia, and then Worlds. And Asia and Worlds are two completely different kettles of fish, as Zoe knows, you know, all too well, you know, coming off her most recent experience. So again, there may be, you know, somewhere between 4 to 6 athletes that go to Asia that may not go to Worlds because of how they're going to be able to perform in those different environments.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Like, I do envy you guys, because it's fun to be able to work with the best athletes and all that sort of stuff. But with it obviously comes a lot of pressure to get these types of things right. So coaches at the VJBL level that are going through team selection at the moment, I promise you, it doesn't get any easier. So good luck with it. It's just know that you're going to upset someone somewhere.
Yep. And that's I was just going to say, you just have to be okay with the fact that people are going to be upset. They're going to have their opinions, whether they make them public or not. They probably are, but especially at this level. But you just have to be – you. If you are – content in the fact that you've done the work, you've done the research, you have all the understandings, you've spoken to all the relevant people, you've done all of that, then those people aren't worth your time or your consideration.
Yep. Excellent. So, well, coaches, good luck with it.
I think it was Greg Popovich who said, if you want to be liked, don't go into coaching.
Yeah.
Fairly accurate. Or refereeing, probably. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's, you know, there's a few of us that have those targets on our back, but that's okay. Coaches, that does wrap us up for this week again. Thank you, too, for jumping in. I've just seen how long we've gone for, and we've maybe added some additional travel time for some of the coaches out there.
Yeah.
It's always.
Yeah, they might be going to Bellarine.
They might be going to Bellarine. Like, probably not this week, but, you know, at some stage it might be happening. But coaches, once again, please do reach out if you need anything on the coaching side of things. You can use the hashtag Talking Split. The ratings, the reviews, the likes, the shares, the retweets are always very much appreciated. And we will catch you guys next week. Good luck with your coaching and with the trial process. Tune in and join the tribe on iTunes.